Ladies and gentlemen, proletariat and bourgeois, comrades and tea partiers, muggles and wizards, haves, have-nots, and have-some-want-mores, welcome to the Priori Incantatum Radio Hour with your hosts, Tylor Slinger and Brian Hill.
Hey, 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 everybody. Welcome back to the 15th installment of the Priori Incantatum Radio Hour. I hear a bottle cap being screwed on in the background by my co-host, Mr. Slinger. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing good, Brian. I just killed a bottle of Patty, so I figured I'd put it aside.
I can't say that I approve of a dead Patty because I'm Irish, but I get it.
Well, that just means I am feeding your countrymen. Providing them with surplus value. So
perhaps.
How you doing this evening, sir?
Not too bad. We had a little technical difficulties on liftoff here. We had to delay launch for about 15 minutes, but we're back. We're ready to rock. Got a surly abrasive today.
Ooh, yes. Is that any sort of inclination to how you're going to be this evening? Is that?
It could be. This is, it's 9% alcohol, which is a little heavier than usual. It's a double IPA made with oats. It's actually quite floral, quite citrusy, but it's packing a punch. And this is, as far as calories go, this is about 1/7 of my intake today. So
nice.
Yeah. Could get interesting.
I just like that metric in all. Like 1/7 of what I've eaten today is alcoholic.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, back in the day, that ratio probably ran a lot higher, but.
There's actually a group of monks somewhere that used to do a beer fast, essentially, is what they would do. Or they would drink meat or something, but they would fast for, like, I think it was Lent or something, and they would, only drink beer or ale or whatever they had at the time. So,
well, this will be our last podcast then because I'm going to join the monastery.
Oh.
Those monks know how to make some beer.
That's true.
Those Trappist ales, the Belgian Trappist ales, those are phenomenal. Actually, this abrasive kind of reminds me of Belgian a bit just because it's kind of citrusy. And higher alcohol content. So, oh, I do love me a good Belgian.
Nice.
But yeah, those things will knock you on your ass.
Yeah, I could imagine that there was a lot of, I don't know, just hanging around happening. Maybe they had their jobs and their calligraphy and their kind of print and scribe work to be done. But I can't imagine that it was the most productive, you know, month for them.
It may have produced some interesting works.
Yeah. I'm curious what sort of, you know, we could do a little bit of what sort of scribing had occurred at that time during that particular month and, you know, shifted history or shifted the way that particular books had. We'd have to get a list of books, but there's a great book out there called The Irish Saved Civilization that basically talked about, I think it was Irish monks who actually... what did they do? They protected many of the world's books and they recopied them back over. I think is kind of the juxtaposition. I haven't read the book in years, so okay. I think that's what it is. They essentially saved history and a lot of the stuff that we know today from, like the old Roman Empire and things like that. They had rescribed books or found them and collected them where the Scots were kind of, the Vikings were tearing through the northern parts of the land and destroying civilization at that point. Hmm. So kind of the idea that they had saved history and kind of these relics. So again, maybe they modified the history a little bit.
Well, they were drunk, so who knows? But like an Irish monk, Brother Seamus. Yeah. Oh, shit.
Now that we've offended the Irishman.
Hey, I'm not offended.
That's
true. You just said they saved history.
That is true.
You know, if you're going to save history, you probably get a little leeway to color it a little bit, right?
I think so, right? Like the whole Vikings wearing skirts thing.
And having, and having long blonde braids.
Yeah, I mean, you're telling me there wasn't a little creative license with that?
That's a historical fuck you, I believe.
I think so.
What should we say about the Vikings? Well, they wore dresses, and let's say they had pigtails.
That's great. I'm trying to think of what other sort of stuff could they have done at that time? They carried these, instead of carrying big shields like the Romans, they carried these bucklers that were basically purses for shields.
And they liked to eat meat stuffed into sheep's intestines. Isn't that what haggis is?
I think so. I think so.
Bladder or something?
No, I think you're right on the money with that.
And they used to hit balls of dried poop around and called it golf.
We definitely have created an international incident with this between the Irish and the potential what would you call them, the Scots. Sorry, EU, not our fault.
Yeah, well, you know, they got bigger fish to fry. There are larger world conflicts than centuries old Irish coloring of history.
True, very true.
Alleged coloring of history.
Alleged, yeah. Our interpretation of what probably, maybe, kind of could have happened.
Might have. Yeah.
Should have. So what's on your mind this evening, man?
Well, you know, we had talked about discussing a lawsuit that was filed today in the state of Minnesota by the NAACP is a party. It's seven families and one community organization filed against the state of Minnesota regarding their alleged failure to provide adequate education for poor and minority students in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And as we've talked about on our podcast before about the achievement gap, it is quite acute in Minneapolis and to a slightly lesser extent St. Paul. When it comes to minority students and their performance on standardized tests. So, again, a lawsuit was filed today. Basically, what they're wanting is to force the state to create a metro-wide integration plan, including redrawing entire district boundaries. The suit is the first of its kind in the country in recent years, they said, after state and federal policies have moved away from forcing a racial balance in schools.
It's interesting. I had read a little bit about it. I caught a clip on the morning news this morning and then kind of read up on it a bit, that I've always understood since I was even in, you know, school in the late 90s, early 2000s, that Minnesota was an open enrollment school. Or a state, so you could literally go wherever you wanted, so long as you could make class. Like, they would only provide busing within the district.
Well, it's a little different than that. So they have
okay.
So there was a lawsuit about 20 years ago that I think finally resolved in some actual action, right around 2000 or so, and it was focused on Minneapolis, and there was a basically choose your school kind of. Program. They have a specific name for it. So students in the north half of Minneapolis, it's called The Choice Is Yours. So students on the north side of Minneapolis could apply to go to schools in Columbia Heights, Hopkins, Robbinsdale, St. Anthony, New Brighton, St. Louis Park, or Wayzata. Students south side of Minneapolis could go to Eden Prairie, Edina, Richfield, or St. Louis Park. And basically, they were going to get priority placement in these schools, and they were reserving spots for these students to be bused. So going from one of those parts of Minneapolis to one of those schools, they actually would be bused, and that was paid for by the state of Minnesota.
So really, in my mind, what we're talking about is busing money. Is that kind of the piece to it? Because again, I don't know if this is true. I'll have to go back and verify, because I just remember from back when I was a kid and going to school, and you could switch schools. I lived on the cusp between two rural towns. I lived in Frazee, Minnesota, but I ended up going to school in Detroit Lakes. So, you know, they were 15 miles apart from one another, and I had to drive myself to school, but that was kind of that's the trade-off that you had. So what it sounds like here is that they were essentially going to have applications to schools in the area, and then those schools were going to be obligated to bus the kids in. Is that kind of is a priority placement only for minorities and people of low income, or is it people from other districts? How are they kind of splitting that? Do you know? I know it's kind of nuanced for
no,
sure.
You're right though. It's a good point. It was for students who qualified for free or reduced lunch. That's what got you into the program, to leave your district, your home district, your home school, I should say, and go to a school in one of these other cities.
Okay.
So that was a qualification. Let me just see here. The thing that struck me reading the Star Tribune article, first off, was that this lawsuit is being brought by the same attorney who brought this lawsuit 20 years ago.
That's interesting.
So the case will be led by the same civil rights attorneys, Daniel Shulman and his son John, who 20 years ago represented the NAACP when it sued the state on similar grounds. That case led to the Choice Is Yours program, which allowed low-income students from Minneapolis to enroll in suburban districts. So here's the thing, because in the lawsuit they filed today, one of their complaints was that, let me grab it here. Sorry. I'm trying to scroll through this article.
No problem, man.
The lawsuit says that open enrollment to suburban and charter schools has resulted in the two districts becoming isolated with poor and minority students. So, but the original lawsuit, whatever the action was out of that, was that kids had more choice in schools, right?
Yes.
They could leave their home districts, which were underperforming, and go somewhere else. So that happened for a certain extent or a certain portion of the student population. And the ones that left behind, there was even a greater concentration of poor and minority students, the ones that were quote unquote left behind. So, I mean,
they essentially exacerbated the issue.
Right. And what they're suing for now is basically to undo what they did 20 years ago.
They had, I was going to ask you about this, because they had referenced in one of the articles, community-based education, or can't remember, community policy education. And for me, I thought that was odd, right? Because the intention and what people have talked about is that, you know, people need to have schools in their communities that they can feel that they can go to. But instead of busing them out of the city, which is what we're doing currently, or out of their area, this is actually a discussion on Bill Maher previously.
Gross.
So, yeah, it kind of flabbergasted me quite a bit, to the point that, you know, the schools that are now performing are kind of being told that they're going to, I'm not really sure what any of this is going to have to do. They're going to redraw the districts, and then if you still have open enrollment, if you still have the Choice Is Yours program, people are just not going to go to the schools. They're going to go to the schools that they had originally chosen. I don't know how any of what they've proposed thus far is going to change anything that they're kind of peeking at. Did you read anything else? What are they looking for specifically? Are you?
You know, that's a good point, because it's really not clear. All they really talk about is the complaint that was filed, but they don't, as far as I could see, they're not making their demands clear, right?
Yes. I'll give you my speculation, a little bit of my conspiracy on this.
All right, good.
My conspiracy on this is that this is a fishing expedition, that the Minneapolis and St. Paul schools are getting hit by pundits and by regulators or people looking at it and saying, what is wrong with this, right? Why do you have I can't remember what we looked it up. We looked it up in a previous episode, less than 40% reading standard rate, and your graduation rates are terrible. Why do you have these outcomes when juxtaposed against the fact that both Minneapolis and St. Paul schools receive more money per kid than any other district in the state? how is it that these outcomes are so poor, even though we're giving you so much money? And they're kind of trying to, I guess, shift the blame at this point, or provide some sort of explanation that it has to do with segregation, is a word that they had used continuously in a couple of the articles that I had read. I really don't see how anything that they have proposed or kind of are they're looking at, if you redraw the districts and we still have open enrollment, you're going to have people go to the schools that they had hoped to go to anyways, or at least apply there and hope to get in. You're not going to really reshuffle the cards as much as you think you would have. The additional piece is that there's been this back and forth between, you know, community schools where people should have schools in their neighborhood or in their area that they can kind of connect with, and the schools can be active in the communities, and kind of that back and forth between them where the community feeds the school and the school feeds the community.
A little house on the prairie schoolhouse,
yes.
Utopian view, right?
Exactly. But they've gotten away from that, and now they look like they're going back to the same model, like you had said, that they basically threw away 20 years ago. I'm not seeing it. This really feels like a fishing expedition that they're going to try to dig into the records. You get a lawsuit. There's probably a discovery period. I think the state is probably going to open it, right? They're going to honor the lawsuit. They're not going to dismiss it. And it's going to allow this organization or this conglomeration, this collective of people, to start to dig into other statistics and data that the districts might have, or information the data might, or the districts already have. And then I think what we're going to see is we're going to see a pivot and a shift in the lawsuit, where they were talking about these specific issues that they're alleging. They're then going to find one particular thing and then latch onto it. The corollary I'm seeing is kind of the Republicans with Hillary Clinton, right? They started with Benghazi and then they got onto the emails. They unfortunately have not focused enough on the emails, but I'm seeing a kind of a small corollary here where they dig into one issue. They use one issue to get in the door and then kind of start digging and tunneling from there to try to find other things to make an issue or to kind of raise from there. So I don't think the issues that we're looking at right now are what we're going to be talking about in a year from now once they've dug through the discovery.
Yeah, that could be.
That's my conspiratorial view. What are you thinking?
I'm not quite sure what their aim is here, because the only thing they're really asking for, it seems, is a redistricting, which I'm not sure what the aim of that is. It seems like they want to stop open enrollment, right?
It kind of does.
Or it could be the reverse, right? They're going to start to want kids from these outer suburbs, first and second ring suburbs, to start coming into these inner city schools.
That's the other thing, yeah. Where they either mix them or they have some specific quotas, you know, even though that's a four-letter word for most of the schools.
Right. But what it feels like to me is they're still avoiding the root causes. Even if these schools are poor, it's no reason, even if the students that go there, their families are poor, and they're all on free or reduced lunch or whatever, and they're minorities, shouldn't really have anything to do with how they're performing, right? They're avoiding the hard question: is why are the students in these schools not doing well? Is it the school's fault? Is it something to do with the average student's family life? There are larger societal questions that they don't want to answer. They want to try to get around that. And if that means, you know, we bring in a bunch of suburban kids into these Minneapolis schools to make their test scores look better, but really, how are those specific minority students going to be performing? Are we just talking about raising the school's average by bringing in other students from more stable homes?
Make them look better, at least, right? Kind of gloss over.
But when
instead of addressing the issue, right, what you're saying.
Well, that seems to be it, right? There's a reason why these schools aren't doing well. It's not because they don't have enough money, because, like you said,
that's for sure.
They get one of the highest per pupil funding rates in the state. Again, there's hard questions that need to be asked. Why are these students not doing well? What is it about the students that's what they should be studying, right? But they don't want to know the answer. It's because a lot of these kids don't have dads. It's because there's not a lot of structure at home. maybe their parents, or single parent or both parents, are working two or three jobs in this economy to try to make it, you know, because everybody's working three part-time jobs if you're not full-time employed. And
yep,
there's no time for parents to parent anymore.
Well, and you kind of hit on
it. Unless you're going to just, you know, surrender to the state and get on welfare and all that, but I'll give them credit that they're trying to avoid that, right?
Absolutely.
And some of it is just bad parenting. And how do we get around that, right? I mean, when the parents don't care, why do the kids care? Why should the kids care? Why should we expect the kids to care? Unless they have something within themselves that says, well, my parents are wrong and I need to do better, or I'm going to do this for myself. But that's a very rare circumstance when you have a school-age child with those kinds of thoughts.
Absolutely. I completely agree on that thought. It's interesting to think about the fact that, again, most of these students are being forced to be there as well, is kind of my thinking. You don't have people who are voluntarily showing up. They don't have an investment in it. Something I think, God, I can't remember who had said it, but once you spend money on a product or a service or something, you're more likely to actually like that particular service and to try to make it work than if you don't spend money on it, because you don't value it as much. You don't have as much invested. And I think that has been part of what has come in with the public school system, is that everybody pays for it, so nobody bears the full cost. The student certainly doesn't bear the full cost. The parents certainly don't bear the full cost. It's, you know, quote-unquote society at large that bears the full cost of it. Right. So the other thing that I thought was interesting with these articles that I'll just pivot to is that they were talking about the fact that they have a large association of minority students in some schools and a large association of poverty in the same schools. Well, I think we've hit on before that national statistics show that if you are of a minority group, you will be, on average, have less money per household. So they're essentially double dipping on the same statistics. They're claiming that we have two problems when in fact we have one, in their mind. I, again, am curious, what is going on with these schools that we're spending more money in, but we're still not able to educate these children? What is holding them back? You know, is it the institutions? Are the class sizes too big? That's something that goes back and forth. People debate about class sizes all the time. From what I've read in the meta-analysis that I've read, class size, you know, is effective half the time or some of the time, but not all the time. They can't find the particular drivers where class size is actually effective. But if you're getting more money than any other district, you should also have some of the smallest class sizes in the entire state, allowing you to drive and have more personalized education. So you can kind of potentially take into account some of those other sort of factors where, you know, maybe the home life isn't as driving, or, you know, maybe you have other athletics or other outlets for kids to go into. It's interesting to me that, to kind of pull back, the other interesting thing on this is that the lawsuit is not against the school district of Minneapolis or the school district of St. Paul. It's only against the state of Minnesota. And they specifically said that is because the state of Minnesota is accountable for the education of our children. It's not actually the school districts or the school boards. So it also gave me an interesting kind of insight that they're not going to blame the school districts for their performance. They're going to go after the state. They're going after the big wallet in this instance, at least in my opinion.
So is that what you think it is? You think this is a money grab, that,
well,
they want more money to go into these districts to try to repair the poor performance?
I think that's at least part of it. I think we'll definitely see more money flow into there. I think one of the articles I read said that the state spent something like $100 million on desegregation efforts or integration efforts, things like that. I don't know if that was a year or over a course of several years, but it seems like there's going to be potentially more money or different efforts put into this, so which will cost money anyways, but it just seems like they're blame shifting. Honestly, in my observation of that, the fact that they're not going after the superintendents of, or the, I'm trying to think of who's the principals and the superintendents of the actual school districts, I found as interesting, as they are the boots on the ground. They're supposed to be the people that are culpable and are supposed to be actually in charge of educating the youth. And they're going after the you know, the granddaddy, right? The people that the Constitution says that the state of Minnesota is somewhat accountable for the education of children in the state. So it seems there's blame shifting, at least. I think sure. There's at least a blame shifting going on. I don't know if they're going to grab for money. They seem to have plenty of that at this point.
Perhaps suing the state allows them to consolidate, because otherwise they'd have to sue Minneapolis and then St. Paul separately, I'm guessing.
That's a good point.
So that might have just been a consolidation effort there. I did a little just Googling, and so there's this the Choice Is Yours program that they instituted as a result of the previous lawsuit. And in 2003, this Education Department of Minnesota did kind of a study or a survey just to try to gauge how they were doing and what was going on. One of the things that kind of stood out to me was how many people at that point were participating in it and what those students looked like. So they have the suburban choice, meaning you opted to leave your home district in the city of Minneapolis and go to one of those suburban districts that I mentioned earlier. Approximately one out of every four students enrolling in the suburban choice program was white, so about 25%. One out of two students was black, so 50%. Of the roughly 30,000 eligible students remaining in a Minneapolis school, one out of 10 was white and one out of two was black. So you see it right there that obviously, there were more minority students in that district to begin with, but of what was left, the kids who did not go to a suburban school, half of them were black, only 10% were white.
Interesting.
Right.
So the disparity might not actually, it might just be part of the community. The people that live closest in Minneapolis might just be people of minority status.
And that's obviously true. I think if you looked at the concentration, I mean, the population of African Americans in Minnesota is not that great. It's what, 3 or 4 or 5%? But if you look at where they live, it's predominantly in Minneapolis and more so on the north side. But you could see the roots of what we're seeing today in this study done 12 years ago. That of the students that stayed behind, which are now, as we're talking today, these underperforming schools that are the basis of this lawsuit, you know, you could see that obviously there were many more black kids staying in those districts. And I'm you know, you can only assume that that trend stayed the same or continued or was there about the same. Not to mention, you know, in that time, we've had a large influx of Somali immigrants since 2003, mostly to Minneapolis. So you're gonna see that there as well. I think we had maybe talked about this before, or maybe I read it somewhere else. But somebody said we ought to start making a distinction between Native African Americans, which is not to add another hyphen, but you know what I mean. What we would traditionally say is black people. Versus black people who have immigrated here within the last, you know, 15 years. Because I think you might see a difference there. In your traditional Native African Americans, there is that history of English speaking and somewhat assimilation to the country and the city. Whereas with the immigrant population, you know, there's challenges there with kids who don't have English as the primary language at home, and that's obviously going to drag down your performance in an English-speaking school. But they have yet to really break out those kind of statistics, and I think that might be telling as far as how the performance of, you know, because they lump them all together as black students, but I think if they broke it out, you might see maybe that the non-immigrant African-American children are probably doing a bit better than their immigrant peers.
That's interesting.
But we never get that color. We never get that flavor on the statistics. So it's maybe a disservice to both parties, to both the native and the immigrant African-Americans, to put them all together as one group and treat them all the same when they really have very different backgrounds and
needs. Yep.
And needs. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's interesting that there's that generalization, right? You figure that people would want things to be as specific as possible. Like, have you been in the state more than 10 years? Were you born here? All those sorts of kind of precursor pre-faculties that would bake into these sort of scores. But the state is sufficiently happy with black, white, period. And that's right. The discussion, right? And this is what's driving the entire lawsuit at this point. Again, I'm curious. I think a year from now, we're going to be talking about something significantly different. They're going to have pivoted because I think they're basically using these stats to, I wouldn't say drive a wedge, but get their foot in the door to get at something else, to see if they can find anything that is actually incriminating at this point.
What would that bring them?
You know, that's kind of the piece, right? If you get your foot in the door, maybe you find some sort of policy that says, hey, we are aware of this, or, you know, we're not going to do anything about this, or maybe we need to be reaching out. Another thing that they had referenced in an article I had read was the fact that, you know, inner city schools talked about the fact that, hey, we have cultural programs that we have that other places don't offer. So they're actually targeting black communities, again, unspecific, whether or not you're immigrant communities or not, to try to get them to those specific schools, which I just find interesting. You're saying you have this specific specialty that you can offer, a educational opportunity that is not offered in other schools, but then once it potentially drives in, you know, part of the business you were looking for, then you turn on it and say, hey, well, you know, our stats aren't looking so good. And our, you know, our ratios of, again, alleged, you know, quote unquote black, quote unquote white people are out of sync and we need to now reassess this. So I just thought it was a bit interesting that they kind of targeted that as well. I don't think they have any hard evidence that would hold up in court at this point. I don't think there's, if this is the evidence brought to the Supreme Court of Minnesota, I think they lose at this point. I think they have to find something else in records or in school policies to pin them to the wall. That's the only way. Because from what I've seen and what I've read so far, they basically are you know, flaunting a public insecurity of race at this point. That's my opinion on it, I guess.
Well, and looking again at this article, there may be some hints at what you're saying. So the lawsuit alleges that in St. Paul and Minneapolis, the districts have drawn school attendance boundaries that place a large number of minority and poor children in certain schools, while other schools in the districts have large concentrations of mostly white and wealthy children. So even within districts, so they're starting to strike out at not just St. Paul and Minneapolis, but according to the complaint, as more families of color have moved to the suburbs, particularly inner ring suburbs, the state has permitted the drawing of boundaries that deliberately increased segregation, quote unquote. Hopkins, Bloomington, Burnsville, Osseo, and North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale were among the examples. So now they're starting to say that these individual districts are starting to see where their minority populations are concentrating and starting to focus their kids into one school as opposed to integrating them even within the district. So you're, you know, for example, say in Osseo, where you might have, they might have a handful of schools. I think the Osseo district is a little bigger than Osseo.
Osseo's not that big of a town, though. Holy
shmoly. The town itself is not, no, but I think there's the district encompasses a couple schools in Brooklyn Park and maybe even Maple Grove. So what they're saying is that perhaps instead of sending, let's say, just for example, I don't know if this is true, but let's say, you know, among that district, their largest concentration of minority students was in Central Osseo. So they're going to make those kids go, they're setting their attendance maps and boundaries to have all those kids go to the same school, whereas if they opened it up within the district, you could have some of them going to a Maple Grove school, some of them going to a Brooklyn Park school, etc. So that, I don't know if there's any criminality in that, but I think what they're maybe trying to prove is that they're intentionally concentrating minority students into one school.
I don't know. Again, I'll be in a year. Let's come back to this and discuss. But I'm curious, with open enrollment, what are they talking about at this point, right?
Well,
if any student can go to any school.
Is that the case, though? Is that true?
I do think it is. At least, again, 15 years ago when I was in school, a little less than that, that was the case. You could apply at whatever school you wanted, and the money that you had assigned to you by the state got transferred to that school. So it was, this intention was that schools could essentially, if you had a good school and people were drawn to it, they would get the money from the student. At least that's, okay, maybe I'll qualify it. At least that's the way that it worked in northern Minnesota.
Okay, but...
That's the...
But in you mentioned Frazee, and what was the other town?
Detroit Lakes.
Detroit Lakes, so, and you went to Frazee?
No, other way.
Okay.
I lived in Frazee, went to Detroit Lakes.
Okay, so let's say Detroit Lakes school was great and Frazee's was awful. What if every kid in Frazee said, I want to go to DL? They couldn't handle it, right? There's limits on open enrollment as far as how many kids can move from one. Yeah. I think basically every school probably has a number set aside for open enrollment, and once that's met, no one else can come in from outside the district or outside the school, even the school district, the school boundary. It has to be that way, right? You couldn't have every kid from Frazee going to DL. DL would be huge, and the people in Frazee would be sitting with the thumbs up their asses, right?
It's possible. I'm going to take the spirit of what you said, because Frazee had my year, they had a graduating class of 31 people, and my graduating class was 210 people. So the numbers don't really, 31 people is a class, really, but I see what you're saying in the inner city where, class sizes are 1,000 people per grade, where if you have 1,000 people shift, you're going to have some trouble. So, I would be curious if schools actually set that, if they had open enrollment limits. It could operate very, very differently within kind of the city and then the burbs or even the suburbs, right? The exurbs, whatever they call them,
mm-hmm.
where, they can only accept 15 or 20% additional students because they simply don't have the classroom sizes. I could see it. That might be a policy that they're able to, again, latch onto and kind of contort and use to their benefit. I would be curious to see if they had that sort of policy, because with the amount of money that we're throwing at each school each year, if you had an additional 30 students come to your school, we're talking $300,000. I think you could educate them for $300,000. You could figure something out at that point. It might be a little bit more tricky in the inner city. Or in the city, or even the burbs, if you have 1,000 students try to shift. But
yeah, I'm pretty sure from what I read, there's a cap, and I'm trying to find it here. But I
okay
seem to remember something about 500 per district. So say, for instance, Edina had to keep 500 spots open in their schools, and for outside enrollment, and same for like St. Louis Park or whatever. I'm gonna try to find that here, but
I'd be curious how that sort of thing is decided too. Even like with charter schools, or, they have that documentary Waiting for Superman, where there's lotteries in schools out east to get kids in. And it's really the difference between having a good school and a bad school out east. How do they decide if you have, 1,200 kids apply for 500 spots? What do? You have, just a lottery, or do you enroll kids separately? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. So I'm looking at this study that they did in 2003 to see how the Choice Is Yours program was doing. It says the state of Minnesota provides transportation to these suburban schools. Beginning with the 2001-2002 school year, a minimum of 500 spaces each year were set aside across the 8 suburban school districts for students who live within the city of Minneapolis.
So it's very small, too.
Very small.
This was, even if the state has open enrollment, they were specifically targeting the use of busing services from Minneapolis to these eight schools. Okay, so, sorry, keep going.
Well, no, I mean, that was kind of the end of it. But if you think about it, they talked about 30,000 eligible students in the city of Minneapolis on the free or enriched lunch as their criteria. Are they saying that only 500 spots were available for the entire program, or is that per school district? They don't specify here.
I kind of felt per school district, but that might be
500 spaces each year were set aside across the eight suburban school districts.
That's fair. Across means not each. So
it seemed to be that. So I wonder, I mean, again, this is kind of old data. I wonder if that continued to expand as people participated in it, because I assume those 500 spots filled up. Yeah.
That's a fraction. That's not even 10%. We're not even talking 5% at that point. We're talking less than 5%.
Right. So it almost feels like a pilot program.
Yeah. It's actually just over 1%. It's like 1.75% of the students were eligible.
So, yeah. I'm just looking at the Star Tribune article. They just refreshed it as we were talking here. Getting the politicians involved, of course. So,
sorry, quick question. Sorry, yeah. I'm just going to put this out there for you. If it is only 500 kids per year, you know, maybe with some sort of increase, we're not talking, and it's 1.5%, maybe 2%. We'll just go 2% of kids for ease sake. Really, these districts have shown to be how they would have been anyways, is what they're saying. These are the districts that would have occurred with or without this pilot program before. So maybe they're going to make the argument that this didn't go far enough.
Could be. You know, as we talked about, I'm guessing a lot of those students who lived in Minneapolis 10 years ago, their families have moved out of Minneapolis into, you know, first and second tier suburbs. And so now they're targeting those areas because, you know, the allegation is that they're concentrating minority students into particular schools. I'm trying to get at where they're going with this. Because, you know, I mean, there's been a big push for kind of among the Met Council people about getting subsidized housing and low-income housing mixed all around the Twin Cities. So naturally, as that happens, the children among that populace who are now, you know, living in lower-income housing in North St. Paul or Maplewood, they're going to be going to those school districts. So I'm not sure what they're getting at here. Might be the abrasive talking. I don't know.
No, man, I'm going to go back to my conspiracy that it is that this is a conglomeration of the worst statistics that they could find to kind of mount a case in the efforts of actually finding a smoking gun or something. That, you know, people knew, I don't know. Here's another thing.
Well, I mean, they are pretty much, it's not explicitly alleged, but it's almost that these other districts are purposely concentrating students in, you know, minority students into particular schools. So basically they're sacrificing schools in their district to be quote-unquote underperformers to keep their white students in better-performing schools. That's the underlying – that's the vibe I get from this.
That's the underlying allegation is what it sounds like.
Right.
I'd be curious – because that seems something you could find out quite easily, right? If you have student addresses and stuff like that, you just find how many of them live within the district and how many of them are out of sight of the district and then go from there.
But they're even talking about within the district, right?
Yeah.
So within the district, you have different schools and you decide kids from this neighborhood go here or, you know, these street boundaries, this is their home school. Another set, this is their home school, and it seems like they're alleging that there's some gerrymandering of these school, individual school boundaries. That would be interesting. Maybe, you got to figure there's maps available of that or some kind of graphical well, yeah, a map just to show, you know, here's the home district. If you see a little tail cutting out into a certain neighborhood, then you probably can figure out what's going on there, right?
Sure. Yeah. Well, if it doesn't make sense at all, like it goes, you know, in one direction the entire time or something like that, you know, the districts are so weird anyways. It's interesting enough that we had a bunch of school board elections, not, was it Tuesday? Yeah, it was Tuesday. So
How'd that go for you, by the way? You had some referendums in your city.
We had one in my city because we had one last year and they both passed. Last year was 70%. This year was 69%. So my taxes are going up like everybody else's. So I know Farmington had two tax increases going and they both won. So
wow. Times are good, I guess, huh? People can just pitch their money in. See, here in Coon Rapids, we vote for parks.
Yes, you do.
God.
Well, Brian, it's only $24 a month, man. Come on, $24 a month? Don't you get that kind of value out of those parks? Come on.
Well, I did before. And frankly, there are other ways of updating playground equipment than spending $1 million. I mean, they spent $1.5 million on the park that's two blocks from my house. And yes, it's nice. Is it necessary? No. Could they have done it cheaper? They must have been able to, right? I mean, they had playground equipment. What they really needed to do was sand it so you stop getting slivers from it. And then it would have been fine.
So you're talking maybe, you know, a week worth of work for five guys, maybe?
Perhaps.
Maybe. With sanding equipment being, you know, stuff from Menards. So
yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it wasn't that bad. I mean, it was outdated. It was as far as, I mean, just comparing what kinds of playground equipment was there to what's there now. You know, it looks more modern. It's your more typical playground, whereas what was there was the same stuff that I played on the east side of St. Paul when I was five or six, you know, in 1985.
I mean, so really, it looks better.
Well, yeah, it looks better, and maybe that's enough to get, I mean, the park is busy. It was always busy, though. It's the equipment really didn't have anything to do with it. You know, they added some other, you know, added a warming house for the winter here, but they had two hockey rinks before, and now they only have one. So that's a net loss in my mind, but anyway, it's, yeah. I'm not sure which is more, what would you rather pay for, Ty? Would you rather pay more money for schools or more money for parks? If they put a gun to your head, which one would you choose?
Schools.
Really?
Yeah, well, if you have to, right?
At least you get some tangible benefits from a park. I mean, property values have gone up a little bit, and you know, my kids have a nicer place to play in.
I haven't thought about that. Yeah, that's a good point. The property values go up, but I don't know.
Of course, then I tax you more, but the property value is anecdotal just from some of the sales that have been going on in my neighborhood lately.
I'd have to think about it. I guess the schools is the knee-jerk reaction. If gun to my head, one or the other. But you know, allegedly, if you have good schools, you have good property values. So I guess we're in abundance here in Apple Valley.
Well, it is the Apple Valley.
It is. Well, we have some of the, I think.
Whereas I'm in Coon Rapids, which is like the worst city name ever.
Ouch. Yeah. Any idea where that actually came from?
There's a Coon Creek that runs through this city. Yeah, there was a rapids at one point when it met the Mississippi. It was Raccoon Rapids, and I think they just shortened it, and that's what stuck.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, you know, we have top-rated schools without as much money as other places in the state, so I am... It might be, like you said, there's other factors that go into it. So I just think, maybe we'll see with this kind of lawsuit and stuff coming in, whether it be, you know, a new vein of thinking or either a kind of a detour and tangent onto something else. I don't think that we've heard the last of it, for sure. And I definitely think that what they're currently bringing as their evidence is going to be, it's going to be shifting. They have to build a new story. This one's going to play out. This will get them into court. This will get them past the dismissal. But I think they're going to have to, like you'd kind of alluded to, that these other districts might be at fault, quote unquote, that they have some sort of gerrymandering rules or not. That seems, if you have a district map, either a school district or a school board district map, you should be able to tell if the districts are being gerrymandered pretty quickly. You know, if you go online, you can find gerrymandered districts pretty quickly where it's, you know, it's obvious, right? Like you had said, a tail or something that just looks odd, that you're pulling in potential voters and things like that. But I think they're looking for something else. They're looking for something that is actually solvent. So either in a year we'll be hearing and we'll be talking about the new argument, or it'll have dissipated and it won't have gone anywhere. But I just have a hard time seeing, with all the money that's being spent in St. Paul and Minneapolis, how the schools continue to underperform regardless of whatever the factors are. So
yeah, and this push to redo district boundaries, which would be a huge undertaking because they all have their own, you know, they all have their own setup. They have their own infrastructure and administration and all that. It's hard to imagine how that would be beneficial. Unless they're, I don't know, are they talking about maybe they would want Minneapolis proper and all the surrounding suburbs to be one district?
I think you're getting at something, man.
Same for St. Paul, but
a Met Council for Education.
Maybe that's it. Maybe they want to totally blow up. And by blow up, I mean radically increase the number of this, the choice is yours / open enrollment thing, where basically you're going to turn the Minneapolis district into Minneapolis and all of the surrounding suburbs. And that's one district, right?
Yeah.
And then they're going to start chopping up the population by whatever racial characteristics they want or socioeconomic statistics, and start distributing them evenly across all the schools in this area. And the same on the St. Paul side, right?
I could see it.
It might be. That might be the aim. It's hard to tell. Just getting back to this updated Star Tribune story real quick. They interviewed the chairman of the Senate Education Committee. It's Chuck Weiger, the DFL from Maplewood. He said the state has worked... The state has worked to close the achievement gap by providing integration aid and increasing its investments in early education. Asked if a settlement were possible along the lines of a quote-unquote choice is yours expansion, Weiger said, "We have a system of open enrollment where choice is available." As for redoing district boundaries, he said there was, quote, "no legislative appetite," unquote, for a proposal along those lines. So the battle lines are already being drawn here, right? He's saying there's no appetite to redo these districts, and you already have a choice. So basically what he's saying is we're not going to change anything unless a court orders us to.
Pound sand is what it sounds like.
Yeah. Interesting to hear from the DFL. I wonder who's bringing this suit. They don't name the community group. I don't think that's behind or a party to this lawsuit, but I know there's been there's some conservative group that's been pushing for education changes in Minneapolis. I forgot their name, the Education Minnesota, that's the teachers union. I've seen them on Twitter, I forgot their name, but I wonder if maybe that's it. I don't think they name this group. I'm skimming the
article.
They don't.
No, you're right.
So I wonder if this is a conservative effort to, this might be some subterfuge, kind of a counter-op issue.
You're getting into my territory with,
I am. I'm putting the tinfoil hat on here and I hear the helicopter outside. There it is.
could see that. I'm trying to think of who you're thinking of with regards to the Twitter and whatnot. They're pretty active on Facebook as well. Like,
yeah, I know they're a conservative leaning group that was formed probably within the last year.
Better Ed Minnesota?
Maybe, yeah, that could be a Better Ed. Yeah, they're taking a page out of the Democrats' book with the Better Minnesota. They're talking about better education.
Holy cow, yep. I'm just looking on their page right now, and they actually have a... they posted that article right off the bat for the Star Tribune, so...
Really?
Yep.
Well, now it gets more interesting.
2 hours ago, yep.
Any comment from them?
Nope. It's just... They rehash the article and then people start commenting. So nothing off the hat.
Hmm. Could it be them?
I don't know, man. They've been pushing. They've been pushing the stats specifically about skewed salaries and other pieces of information. I remember they were the ones pushing the kind of the education standards into the forthright into the mind. So Game of Loans, yeah, nice. Yeah, they were the it'll be interesting to see how this kind of comes about then. Yeah, it's interesting that the article did not reference the community organization at all.
Yeah, how could that be? We'll have to see if this lawsuit is public yet, if the docs are public, because they'd have to be named, right? They couldn't remain anonymous.
Well, if they were truly a party to it, right? Unless they were just pushing it behind the scenes.
Could be. Let me get that article again. What the hell? Something fishy about this. Can you tell I've had half this beer now? I've only had half this beer and I'm feeling fine. All right. So the lawsuit was filed on behalf of 7 families and 1 community group. But they don't name them.
Nope.
Shit. What was the name of that page on Twitter?
It is Better Ed, and their website is better-ed.org.
Let me see if I can find this here.
They posted the article about 2 hours ago, so it kind of makes me think they'd have to be slow playing it if they were, in fact, the culprit. I kind of don't think so. I think that this has been a more internet-based discussion as far as Better Ed goes. I don't think that they actually are a community organization. I think they're more of a internet-based kind of quasi-think tank.
All right, here we go. So no, I must have the wrong one then. Never mind. Yeah, never mind. It's far too late and I've had enough beer where I'm not going to start. The Better Ed that I pulled up, I didn't see a repost of that article and it didn't. I must have the wrong one pulled up then. So
I'll shoot it to you. Yeah, it is. I'm looking. They're the ones that kind of brought to my front of my mind. The tuition and spending for kids in the St. Paul and Minneapolis schools, because it is, man, it's more than the Minnehaha Academy or Trinity School at River Ridge. It's towards the top, so it's just very interesting as far as money being spent and outcomes not being met. So, I'm going to toss out another conspiracy, man. I'm going to say the unions are behind this. At least in part. We're going to find them. Maybe they're the community organization behind this.
Well, that could be. And in St. Paul, in these school board elections on Tuesday, they brought several candidates who were backed by the union onto the board. So there's going to be a face-off with the superintendent there. I wonder if this is their first shot across the bow here.
I could definitely see that. Yeah, it was. Was that just in St. Paul or was that Minneapolis as well?
I only read about St. Paul. Or I didn't even read about it. I just saw.
Was it how many new board members did they have?
thought there were four.
Okay, of how many?
Well, what do they have? Seven or eight?
Jeez, okay. So, I'm curious if those were contested elections or if they were places where people had stepped down, because you basically can't get elected in St. Paul if you are not backed by the unions. So it would be surprising to me that they were not already union occupied, or kind of the union ratio at that point of union endorsed school board and St. or, you know, city council seats. So,
yeah, I don't know. Well, this is interesting. The timing is interesting right after the election then, right?
Yep, exactly. 2 days, right?
So if it's a conservative-backed group behind this, and they just saw that the teachers' union got several board members elected. See, but what I read about the union-backed school board members being elected was that it was setting up a face-off with the superintendent in St. Paul, because there's obviously some conflict there. So, yeah, I can't make it all jive right now.
It's not making sense, man. That speaks to conspiracy.
Yeah, that's
maybe it's all the unions behind it. They got their school board people on, and now they're creating the conflict with which they will resolve with no problem at all.
I think we need to go back and read Rules for Radicals again. It might explain everything.
It might. Yeah, you got to have multiple facets and multiple angles, right, to drive the masses' attention and their outrage and the machine of outrage that they tend to follow. So, yeah.
It's funny. I just started reading 1984 with my son. So I read to him every other night, basically, and we just finished To Kill a Mockingbird, which was excellent. I never read it before. I somehow got through high school without reading it, but I really enjoyed it. So now we're doing 1984. It might be a bit above his head. I didn't realize how dense it was.
There's a lot of, not necessarily subterfuge, but a lot of linguistics and kind of just discussion, especially because Winston works in the Ministry for Truth, so.
Right, and again, this was written and published, it was published in 1949, it was written in the several years leading up to that, so basically post-war Britain it was written, so that definitely flavors the settings that he describes, but... It's funny, there's the 2 minutes hate, which is that's the outrage machine.
Yep.
The first chapter they're talking about, I forgot the guy's name, but he's, the Eurasia or East Asia guy. He's the focus of their 2 minutes hate. All I can think of was that's Bin Laden.
And, it's Goldberg, right? Or Goldstein?
Yeah, Goldstein. Yes. Yep. He had a Jewish appearance, which at the time, right, might have... at the end of the Holocaust, kind of digging back into, Jews were vilified as part of World War II and the Nazi Party, that would have been, the face, and now it's Islam and Bin Laden being the face of terror, militant Islam. I mean, every time they put his face up on the screen, right, people would probably have some kind of internal reaction to it.
I could see it.
It's, as I told my son, I'm going to try to point out to you the parallels that are drawn to today. So, you've got the telescreens on the wall that record your movements. They can see they can hear what you're doing. They can see what you're doing. That's your home computer. That's your cell phone now.
Yep. Well,
so I haven't read it since high school, so I'm kind of giddy about reading it again.
Re-exploring the past, right?
Exactly, and seeing how it still applies today, in the age of Edward Snowden and his revelations about the NSA and things like that. I mean, it seems to be more relevant than ever. So I'm curious to see, as I read, how many more parallels I can draw to current technology and current government abuses.
I think you'll find more and more of it, right? The children tattling on the parents and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, we just read that chapter where he talks about how anyone over 30 was afraid of kids, and it's funny.
Well, he's not married. He doesn't have any kids. I mean, that's the safest place to be, because right. The kids, you can be turned in as a traitor or as a thought criminal, as they call it,
right,
in your sleep. So the kid just basically has to say, "Yeah, my dad was saying some terrible things in his sleep," and boom, you know, you get pulled in. So.
Right. And that's because he didn't give the kid an extra helping of pudding, right?
Yeah, potentially, right?
Right. I mean, any grievance the kid had, I'm going to turn you in.
Yep.
And they even allude to that because he goes to help the neighbor unclog the drain, and her kids, you know, they're pointing at Winston saying, "Thought criminal." And he's unnerved by it because he was just writing in his diary, you know, down with Big Brother. Oh, that's good stuff. I'm excited to crack that one open again after almost 20 years. Yes, it's been almost 20 years since I graduated high school. I think it's 18 right now.
Old man.
Old man. Gray in my beard, gray on my temples now. I see the gray hairs poking through. It's fucking all over, man.
It is.
No, I will rage against the dying of the night, my friend. Podcasts and dad bands and anything else to try to stay relevant, right?
Yeah, man. I mean, well, once you bring Rogaine into the conversation, then, you know, Rogaine or what's the coloring? You know, accept your gray, dude. That's all I got to say.
Just for men?
Yeah, just for men.
Yeah,
accept
I'm all
right your gray.
With the gray.
Accept your gray.
The balding is a little hard to take.
That ain't your choice, though.
Well, neither is the gray. And
well,
if I didn't have a daughter, I might consider the Rogaine, but there's a lot of testosterone there. It's not something you want your female children to get mixed up with, and even your male children, you don't want them, you know, starting puberty early or all that good stuff. So
I could see it.
I'll just accept it.
You know, I'm trying to think of, you know, Winston Churchill was balding. Trying to think of other acolytes, man. But, you know, accept it, man.
Yeah.
The Catholic monks, they used to shave the top of their heads.
It's true.
So I think it's so they could be closer to God, but
one less layer. See, that's the dilemma I'm going to have, though, at some point is, when have I lost enough hair on top where shaving and just cutting it down is the better option than trying to maintain what was there and, you know, puffing it up a little bit and making it appear that I have more than I do as best I can, even though I'm probably failing miserably at it. So I'm nearing that point. I'm 36 now. I probably got maybe another year or two or three before I really need to start having that conversation with, do I just buzz it down to, you know, an eighth of an inch or whatever, a quarter of an inch, and just let it be what it is?
You know, you could always do what the president of steaks does, which is get a top cover.
What are you talking about? The president of steaks, his hair is 100% legit, my friend.
I guarantee it's probably real, but I don't think he grew it. That's the...
Well, I don't have the money that he does. I can't pay some kid to shave his hair and have him glue it onto my head. Or more importantly, probably rip the hair follicles out and transplant them into my skull.
That's true. Okay, fair enough. You know, bald is the new beautiful, bro.
Yeah, you know. I appreciate the pep talk. I know it's all lies, but I got a little ways to go. It seems like my hair loss is... It's kind of frozen for a little bit here. I don't seem to be regressing quite as badly as I have in the last few years. So maybe I'll just stay like, if I could stay like this, I'd take that.
Well, I might be following you. My mother's father, so my grandfather on my mother's side, he started balding at like 23. Mm. And I luckily have not started doing that yet. I seem to be following in my father and my grandfather and his side's turn of phrase with the hair, but my cousin is not boding so well, even at like 22. Feel bad for me.
Yeah, that's true. I have a cousin who's maybe 30, and he's graying pretty good, and his dad grayed early. My mom's grandfather was, he was bald. I don't know when he went bald. And then my dad's dad, he was bald as well, but he had PTSD from World War II where his hair would fall out when he got stressed. So I guess I don't know, had that not happened, what would he have looked like? I know my dad mostly, he had pretty much had all of his hair when he passed. It was gray, but that was more from the medicine he was getting to try to make him better. So I don't know what's in store for me. But like I said, if I could keep this, even if it went gray, I'd be okay with that.
Maybe you just need to start meditating, dude. Get rid of the stress. Maybe you're just overstressed.
It's probably true. The beer is probably not helping, and the massive amount of alcohol I drank as a 20-something probably didn't help either.
Yeah. But
that was rock and roll, baby.
That is rock and roll.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're up on about an hour 10 here. We should probably cut this one off.
All right, I'm tossing my hands in the air, man. We talked education for a better part of an hour. And
yeah, it's better than we thought we'd do, but there's a lot there, and we kind of did some on-the-fly investigating, and we're going to have to come back to this one because I think even in the next week or two, we're going to get some more information about the parties to this lawsuit and some of the politics behind it, and I think we might have more answers than we have tonight, but still an interesting look at what they're asking for now as opposed to what they asked for 20 years ago. They seem to be contradicting themselves or trying to go back on what they originally asked for and what they got as part of that original lawsuit. And then
no, man, I see what you're saying. Yeah. It's completely, completely kind of a 180 on their part. I'll be curious as this comes up, if it's months, weeks, or even a year from now where we hear from it. It could die into obscurity where nothing comes of it, and this was just a kind of an attempt to recharge, because we do have a presidential political election coming up, so it could be an attempt to recharge the base after an election already. So
yeah, that's
I don't know, man.
I think there's other ways of doing that. I mean, this is brought for a reason at this time. The redistricting piece, that's such a large undertaking. That's a lot to ask for, and I'm not sure what the ends are. Unless it is, like I said, to create one mega Minneapolis and one mega St. Paul district and kind of allow integration across all those lines, where you kind of erase some of those boundaries of Edina and North St. Paul and basically make them one large district and start busing around the whole area. That's going to be expensive. Anyway, we're rehashing and getting into the point here, but we need to cut this one off and
wrap her up.
Let our wonderful listeners go about with their day and pretend like they never heard this dribble. So until next time, we appreciate everybody listening. If you have anything to add on our conversation about education in the greater Twin Cities metropolitan area, please hit us up on Twitter at PI Radio Hour. And until next time, my name is Brian.
I'm Ty.
And we'll catch you on the flip side.